Greetings, dear listener, and welcome back to this week's episode of Gomology. I'm your host, Nick Johannesson, and being predictably unpredictable, it's back to Blighty for another episode, sort of tangentially about clothes and stuff, and it's a super fresh episode, upon which will become apparent. I don't like to keep the topics too narrow. We've got a lot of stuff to cover. I mean, this is about clothes and stuff. So, thanks to those of you that support the podcast on Patreon. It means a lot. More info about Patreon, buying me a coffee or leaving reviews at the end of the episode. If you'd like to suggest a guest, I am all ears. Do get in touch and I'll see what I can do. Contact details also at the end. So without further ado, off to the south coast of the UK to get the lowdown on Tweedy Rap. Hi, and welcome to Gomology, a podcast about clothes and stuff. Now today, something of a breakthrough day, because I've got a genuine superstar within a quite niche area. So welcome, Jim Burke. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, yes, my name is Jim Burke, but I'm known to many as Mr. B, the gentleman rhymer, chap hop superstar.
Now, we're going to talk a bit about the chap hop superstar bit, because obviously that's really interesting. But I like to sort of take my guests a bit back in time to sort of get a sense of where they came from. I mean, how did you start out? You weren't born with a banjo lele in your hand and a rather fantastic moustache, were you? I mean, where did it all start?
Well, I mean, this is, I've kind of been a musician. It's quite rare, really. I've been a what you might call a professional musician for something like 30 years now. I started a couple of bands in the very early 90s, one of whom ended up having one minor hit single. I was in a band called Collapsed Lung, and we had a song which was based around the Euro 96 football tournament. It was called Eat My Goal.
Catchy tune.
It is a catchy tune. I think it still holds up today, actually. It's one of those ones that's just, it's just bouncy enough and not, I suppose it wasn't entirely musically of the zeitgeist, so therefore it seems to still be used today for various things. So I was in a band, I'd been in numerous musical incarnations. I was in a band called the Schooner Boys, which is probably which is definitely the genesis of the Mr. B thing. This was in the mid 90s. We were what I called a dandy punk band. Schooner referring to a sherry schooner. And we would sing, it was sort of all about dandyism and with a little hint of ultra violence, as it were. So we'd sort of have songs like Decanter Riot and what else was there? Feel the Heel of My Chelsea Boot. That was one. So they were kind of slightly dandily aggressive. It's sort of Clockwork Orange meets Jason King.
Okay.
So I did that for a while. And then, there's been numerous things. I did a thing under the name of Sergeant Rock at the turn of the century, which is more a sort of slightly along the lines of Fatboy Slim, sort of big beat, break beat thing. And I first moved to Brighton on the south coast of England 20 years ago and started a little band. Well, I started playing the ukulele and the banjolele and started a little band down here. We ended up just playing we were doing covers. Basically, I was playing banjolele. We had a drummer and a bass player and we just did sort of silly covers on the banjolele. But, it was sort of slightly, on the cusp of when that sort of thing became quite common, but just before, I think, in the era of Nouvelle Vague and all these sort of, people that do strange cover versions of things. That split up, and then Mr. B sort of came together via all those things. It was a sort of combination of all of them, really. So it was a sort of slightly hip-hop thing of Collapsed Lung and the dandyism of the Schooner Boys and the banjolele of Rockonic and Bob and, and the production of Sergeant Rock. So it's, the whole thing came together into something which really shouldn't have made any sense, but somehow did.
Now, this all makes me wonder, were you a musical child from a very posh background?
No, I was a bit of a freak of nature, I think. Most of the photos of me when I was a really small child, I've got a musical instrument in my hand. I was sort of obsessed with music from the start, but my parents, I came from a sort of lower middle class background and, just suburban South London. My parents weren't remotely musical or artistic or anything like that. Nobody in my family was particularly. I just seemed to, I don't know where I got it from. It just came out of nowhere and there it was.
And has carried you in good stead since.
Exactly, yes. You know, I never had any music lessons apart from my friend's dad teaching me those three chords on the guitar, you know, in that, whoever it was that said that, that sort of punk manifesto of like, here's a chord, here's another chord, here's a third one, now start a band.
And I guess the sort of punk manifesto is sort of within what you are doing now, isn't it? Or have been doing all along.
Absolutely, yes, yes. That's the whole thing about me having done this, you know, effectively, professionally, you know, in the broadest sense of the term, for the last 30 years or so, is there's never been a career plan or anything like that. You know, I speak to people that deal in business and things. You know, there's a friend of mine who helps, you know, streamline businesses or what have you, and he's sort of saying, well, so where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I always think, well, I assume I'll be in the gutter. But, you know, but there you go. Not yet.
That sounds good. I mean, the music industry is not kind to, well, artists that aren't huge these days.
No, absolutely. Which is, you know, largely why I kind of just avoid it. And, you know, you can form your own. I mean, luckily, Mr. B started in the days. Funny enough, I kind of started, you know, at the during lockdown, and when I started doing some online streams, I did a night. You know, I do these DJ things. Just streams online, and after a while I was playing so much of my own stuff that people said, why don't you just do a night of just playing music that you've been involved in? And so I made a playlist, and it ended up being over a day long.
Wow.
The playlist. So I thought, okay, and I think I've just written down, I think I've sort of been involved in something like, you know, pretty much directly in about 40 albums or something like that. So it's I actually started, as people did in lockdown, you become slightly you know, you start looking back on things because there's, you know, we didn't know what there was to look forward to. So I started thinking about writing a memoir of sorts. So I did, I've kind of started writing that, and just because I seem to be, you know, I'm on the first draft at the moment, and it's really, it's more of a self-help book about how to get away with doing this without really being involved in the music business at all, or at least, you know, having an experience of it, which in the end wasn't great, and you kind of think, okay, I will not bother with that then. I will just plough my own path. And I was just writing yesterday about MySpace and how I was lucky that Mr. B started in the era of MySpace, which was some, you know, the first platform you could put music onto that everyone could listen to, and it was pre-algorithm, so everyone could actually see it rather than the people that were paying the most money for it.
Right.
So that was a piece of luck for me, really, that Mr. B started in that age. So therefore, you could form a little band of followers and build it from there.
Now, I'm thinking Collapsed Lung was around 2000.
It was actually mid-90s. Well, the original iteration of it. We're doing things again. Now we've done a couple of albums in the last few years. But it was sort of only really 94 to 96 that I was in Collapsed Lung. So it was about 2.5, 3 years.
And that was all Baggy Pants, I think.
It was largely Baggy Pants, yes. It was sort of, I guess it was that era of the, you know, mid-90s where dressing up just wasn't done anymore. People, you know, I remember being surprised. We played a show with the Inspiral Carpets, and I remember being surprised that they brought stage gear with them. But it was really, as in clothes, but effectively they were changing out of one T-shirt, putting another T-shirt on, another pair of trousers, playing the show, and then putting an almost identical T-shirt and pair of trousers on. But I suppose that was a sweating on stage thing,
right,
more than anything else. So, and that's the whole thing. There was certainly, this is the thing I've learned with Mr. B, is there's certainly something to be said for having a look. Because I remember when Collapsed Lung played at the Reading Festival in 94. We were on the main stage. I remember going for a stroll with my brother beforehand. And as we were wandering around, approaching the stage, there was a teenage kid with a Collapsed Lung T-shirt on, walking straight towards us. And my brother was nudging me, going, oh, here we go, fanboy moment coming up. And this kid just, I'm sure he made eye contact with me, just walked straight past, nothing. Not a spark. And whereas the first Mr. B show I ever did in a little festival in someone's back garden, well, it was a little bit bigger than a back garden. It was some who had a sort of field. But as soon as I turned up, people were like, oh, it's Mr. B! Because I had a look, as it were. So, yeah, there's something to be said for that. But yes, back in those days, it was very dressed down. It was sort of post-grunge and hip-hop. And so, yeah, we were somewhere in that wheelhouse, as it were. So it was very T-shirts and baggy trousers and what have you.
So with the Schooner Boys, I mean, continuing a clothes theme here, that was also a sort of poshed-up look.
Yes, absolutely. I'd say the Schooner Boys was a little more of a sort of late, you know, a sort of 60s dandy, a kind of Avengers, Jason King sort of thing. So it was much slightly more flared and fitted. Yeah, a bit, because I tend to be, you know, an Oxford bags type of chap these days and what have you, but, you know, with a fitted jacket. But yeah, so that was a real, I think the thing with the Schooner Boys, I think I was the one that really embraced the whole thing more than others. Others would turn up and put something, a jacket on, where I'd go out shopping for things and see what I could find.
Yeah. So when you came to then creating the Mr. B persona, I'm a bit curious, because Chap magazine and the Chap movement also sort of rose up at some point in this. And I think it's fair to say you're kind of aligned with them or involved or at least related.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Well, I'm the current cover star, which is rather pleasant. Yes, I'm on the cover of the Chap magazine at the moment. Yes, definitely. I think that was because I think they started, it's their 25th anniversary this year. So they started at the end of the 90s. And so it definitely was a reaction to this sort of dressed down 90s thing. Kind of, right, let's dress up again. I remember, yes, and I sort of, Mr. B came out of, you know, various things, but one of them was, me and some friends of mine used to just have a regular, go out for a drink on a Wednesday evening, and I decided, I was looking for a way, this thing, I always have to create the universe, I can't just put some clothes on, I have to make a huge, you know, universe of excuses for it. So I sort of said, why don't we do, when autumn comes round, let's do suit autumn. So it was like, okay, when we go out in the autumn, we wear suits. I think me and there was one other of us that was, you know, half into it, but not hugely. But I was the one that, I think I just wanted to start dressing better. And that's, you know, it was one of those nights when I sort of had the idea for Mr. B. It pretty much came to be fully formed.
Right. Because, I mean, there hasn't really been anything like that before, has there? I mean, how would you describe Mr. B? And use as many words as you like.
Okay. Well, you know, when I first came up with it, it was sort of a culmination of the other things I'd done before. So I the original idea was, straight away, I was like, Mr. B the Gentleman Rhymer, it was going to be called Chap Hop. Because, yeah, that's the thing, one of the things I wanted to do was, I think that was a thing as well, I'd started reading the Chap magazine a couple of years before. And I wanted in, as it were. And I think the Schooner Boys had sent them a CD or something. And it, yeah, nothing came back from that. But then, yes, I started doing Mr. B. And, yes, the Chap magazine suddenly became interested, which was nice, and kind of got to know them. But, yeah, it's, well, as I say, it's Chap Hop. It's often I describe it as either, well, if you imagine Noel Coward, George Formby and Chuck D from Public Enemy getting drunk in a bar on sherry and deciding to form a band, it would be something along those lines. It's music hall hip-hop as well, I'd call it. So it was that sort of that kind of thing. There were people like Ronald Frankau who did, you know, and Noel Coward often do it. It's, you know, talking over music, which, you know, in a way is kind of like rap. So, yeah, I brought the whole thing together, and so I just started sampling some old ragtime things. It was all fairly simple at the start, just sample a little ragtime sample or something. The first one I did was A Piece of My Mind, which was a sample from Robert Crumb's band, the comic artist. He had a sort of a ragtime band. Yes, he did, yeah. They're great, actually. Mm. They're really good. I'd highly recommend having a look. So a sample of that, popped a beat on it, did some rhyming about, you know, whatever dandiest topic I could think of at the time. And it was that, just one of those things. It was one of those things that was a bit of an experiment, but somehow worked. Whereas it probably, you know, really on paper, it should not have worked at all, but it actually went down really well. And I think I just hit the right moment. There was, you know, a slight change towards, you know, people are started wearing vintage clothes, or at least I discovered these people as I was going along. So, yeah, it's sort of music hall hip hop, really.
I guess you had a sort of kind of ready-made audience there who were just looking for the sound that they required.
Yes, exactly, yes. It's that kind of modern, yeah, that very much like the Chat magazine is. It's sort of slightly a modern, slightly skewed, slightly amusing view of old things and a slightly amusing, old, skewed view of new things, yeah, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah, because they're not a vintage movement. They are kind of a reimagined vintage, I suppose.
Yes, yeah. I think that was one of the things I was conscious of as well. There was definitely, especially as a lot of, you know, I have a lot of fans in the sort of vintage scene, as it were, but, you know, I do have to explain that there is hop in Chap Hop. So it's not, you know, it's things like I will wear, you know, a nice pair of Adidas shell toes with a suit. But, you know, you have to even, you know, even with that kind of footwear, with trainers, you have to pick it carefully. You know, you do have to curate it. But that was one of the things I was looking for. I think that sort of, you know, that mix of old and new. Was it, they said on the Mighty Boosha, a mixture of old things and new things to make something not quite as good as either.
I think that's what you're saying there is very right, because I see, if I Google you, I see, oh, Mr. B, he's a parody musician making something like that. But you're not really, are you?
No, this is the thing. I do need to have a look at that. That's on Wikipedia, isn't it? It says, yeah, Mr. B is a parodist. I'm not a parodist. I'm most of the things I do, it's, you know, 90% of what I do is original material. It's just, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say I parodied things. I maybe more pay homage to things.
And what you make is very, very happy music. At least I find it to be.
Well, good. That's what I'm here for, really.
Now, and of course, I mean, it helps that you are actually a genuinely accomplished rapper.
Well, that helped. I think that's the thing as well. This is one of the things, particularly about being, you know, a white, funny rapper, is you've got to, there is, you know, that usually would translate to a comedian who's taking the mickey out of hip-hop because he doesn't really understand what it is. Like, there was various, you know, tunes in the 80s like Morris Minor and the Majors stutter rap, and it was just sort of, oh, isn't this, you know, weird trending music funny, let's take the mickey out of it. Whereas this is a genuine, you know, I genuinely love hip-hop, so it's, but I've just skewed it somewhat. So it's definitely, yeah, you have to try and do, I was conscious always to try and do each bit of it, the production, the banjolele playing, the rhyming, as well as I could.
So if we're going to look back on your own sort of musical history as a listener, I mean, where did you start out? When did you discover the hip-hop?
Well, you know, I think I was probably a little bit late to the game, as it were, because I was in the early, very early 80s, I was more of a, you know, even though I was about 11, I was a rockabilly. Oh. And I still, you know, at heart, I still am kind of a rockabilly. and yes, it wasn't until a bit later on, probably till the Def Jam era, as it were, the Run DMC and the Beastie Boys and Public Enemy and LL Cool J, that I got into it. My younger brother was actually much more, I suppose in a way he's more mainstream, because that was the thing to listen to in those days. It was in the early 80s, there was the Street Sounds Electro compilations.
I remember them
and
well.
Lots of, yes, yeah, there's hip-hop compilations and, yeah, people like Houdini and Melly Mel and Grandmaster Flash, all those sorts of things that he was more into than I was. And then I, you know, sort of suddenly, I'll say suddenly switched, but I also realised the kind of power of sampling and how it makes a kind of cultural signpost for what you do. In as much as, well, as I do now with Mr. B, it's lots of old music hall samples and 1920s and 30s jazz chopped up and mucked around with. So it's a good way of sort of setting out your stall as to what you do. But yes, I was originally a rockabilly, then so gradually went via various things. I've always loved pop music as well, I have to say. It gets a bad rap and isn't necessarily taken seriously, but I do love a bit of pop music.
Nothing wrong with a good pop tune.
No, absolutely.
So you got into hip-hop, but then when did you become an artist?
Well, I suppose you just gradually do that. I was, yes, as I said, I was always wanted to play instruments. So, you know, every Christmas or birthday, there'd be a new little Casio keyboard or something like that. And I started probably in my early teens. I think my mum got me this sort of tape-to-tape karaoke machine thing so I could record, say, a drum machine onto one tape, switch it onto the other tape, record, you know, record over that. So it was also a dubbing thing, just, you know, very simple dubbing over the top of a tape. And that would also create, because you'd end up with about five generations in of this tape, and it would create a very crunchy sort of compressed sound just because it had been recorded over so many times. So, yeah, I just started just, yeah, it was a very misspent youth, really. My teenage years were largely spent in my bedroom recording rather than going out and doing things. So, yes, I sort of gravitated towards that. And then you start, you know, you get to a certain age. I think I went to art college. That was the thing that changed it, really. At 18, I went and, yeah, to study at art school. And like most of them do, most of the people in my sort of position have probably been to art school. And so, yeah, met a few people there. And just, yeah, you gradually form these little allegiances and alliances, as it were. And just started a couple of bands and then eventually ended up, I actually joined Collapse Lung. They'd already been going for a year or so, but it's just that their rapper left, and I was reading the NME with another friend of mine who was in a band who'd played with Collapse Lung a few times, and we were reading that Nihal, who's now actually he's now a BBC radio DJ, he'd left the band, and I sort of said, I could do that, and, you know, half joking, and my friend said, you could actually, yeah, and gave me their number, and there I was suddenly, I wasn't really a rapper previously, I'd dabbled, but there suddenly I was a full-time MC, which was a bit of a culture shock, but it was, I got away with it. I'm still getting away with it, it seems.
You mentioned doing overdubs on your little reel-to-reel karaoke machine. I often think that it's sort of the technical limitations like that that really bring out the creativity.
Absolutely, yes. I've just got a little sampler thing myself. There's a company called Teenage Engineering, who is a Swedish company.
Brilliant name.
Yes, it's great. And they do they're kind of a design company, but they make synths and things like that. But they always look, it looks like, tell you what, I'll, it's over there, I'll show it to you. Obviously, if it's an audio thing, it's completely irrelevant, but I'll show it to you anyway, because it looks like an old calculator.
As long as it makes sounds.
There we go, let's pop these back on. Here we go. This is the Teenage Engineering KO2.
It looks like something you'd find in an accountant's office 30 years ago.
Exactly that. But it's... Anyway, it does lots of lovely things, but it's at the same time, it's just got sort of four tracks, and you can't put anything else more than four tracks on it. Yeah. So it's more of a kind of sketchbook. But that's the thing. It's nice to have these things just to the immediacy of it and to come up with things very quickly. I found that, you know, a year or so ago, I was trying to write a kind of brilliant album. And you find that if you've got that in your head, thinking, I have to make this as good as possible, often that leads to, well, being a bit stuck. Whereas if you go into the studio and think, I'm going to do anything today, it doesn't matter what it sounds like, suddenly you'll do all your best work.
Mm. Yeah. You know, it just struck me, I've got this thing about bands who are making 80s style music today
who sound nothing
at all like what the bands sounded like in the 80s, even though they have all the right presets in their software. And I'm thinking that has to do with the bands that were actually in the 80s were on this voyage of discovery. There was all this new equipment that much of it wasn't very good. It was full of limitations, but they were trying to make cool stuff anyway. And that's why it sounded like it did. And even though if you have all those sounds today, you can't get that same feel to it.
That's true, actually. Yes, it is that thing that it's now almost people are kind of unlearning things because there's so much you can do. They're having to try and limit themselves rather than, yeah, it being the opposite when you're trying to get as much as possible out of very simple equipment, people are now trying to reduce things down. There's like some of these samples have like a vinyl simulator and a cassette simulator to make it sound like it was recorded in the 80s or the 70s or whatever it is. They'll just put a, you know, a sheen over the top of it, or an unsheen, if you will, just to take, so everything always sounds so bright and nice, and you know, you can immediately make things sound brilliant now. Whereas people are sort of going for, I mean, I listen to a lot of what you call like lo-fi hip-hop, and it is that thing that is, and also things like vaporwave and synthwave, which are, I mean, vaporwave's kind of an incredible thing that it's almost not really music at all. It's that a lot of the time it's just a chunk of an old, like usually late 80s, sometimes early 90s, but usually late 80s song, slowed down with loads of effects on it. So it just sounds like a, what do they call it? It's ghostology or something like that. I can't remember what the name for it was.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, no, hauntology. That's it. Hauntology. Yeah. Whereas it's sort of, it's about creating an atmosphere and a sort of, almost like, you know, evoking childhood memories. It's almost like, you know, regression therapy or what have you.
I've often thought about adding something like that in the background to my podcast recordings to make them even more of an artifact.
Ah, there you go. Yes. Well, you have to have a word with me. I may have a few things that you may be able to use. Because I've got, yeah, some of the things I do under the name of The Major, which is another little thing I do, are more sort of slightly odd electronic whimsical things. But would probably suit, you know, bedding music for a podcast and here and there.
Yeah, because Mr. B isn't even, and The Major aren't even the only things you do.
No, it's true enough. Yeah, well, as I said, that Collapsed Lung is still around. Actually, it was my 40th birthday. My wife arranged a surprise party for me. And part of the surprise was she got the band back together. She came up to me and said, oh, it's not the only surprise. You're doing a gig. And I thought, oh, someone must have brought my banjolele along, so I'll do a Mr. B gig. And we hadn't done a Collapsed Lung gig for 15 years. And she's like, no, you're doing a Collapsed Lung gig. And she'd got the band back together behind my back. But we had such a good time that we thought, after a while, we did a couple of shows, and this was a few years ago. Then we didn't do anything for a bit. And then one of them just said, why don't we just get into the studio and write some new things? And so we just released an album last year called Collapsed Lung Weekend Television. And then an album about 5 years ago called 0 Hours Band. And so, yeah, we're just doing that. And, you know, we're certainly not doing it for the money, that's for sure. But it's been fun doing it. And, I also do some sort of what you might call lo-fi house music under the name of Jason Rollbars as well. And these are often things that I do if I finish a Mr. B album. Or I've been doing a lot, you know, heavily doing a lot of Mr. B things. I'll often just do that, these other things as a way of relax, you know. So I make music professionally, but I also kind of make music to relax as well. So yeah, when I finish a Mr. B album or a long stint of Mr. B shows, I will probably end up doing an album by The Major or something like that, which is a different thing. It's still slightly whimsical and slightly chappy, but not as much as Mr. B.
Yeah, the fact that you can make a living off making music is incredible.
Yes, it is. It's quite unusual. It's not. Yeah, I've managed to get away with it for this long. So it's like, you know, I count my blessings every day. It's marvellous to be able to do this as a living, you know, to not have to work a job and then do this as a, you know, hobby. It's how I earn my money, which is quite pleasant. Obviously, this time of year is a slightly different kettle of fish because there's very little happens in January and February as far as gigs go. So I'm off on tour in April, so I've got to tide myself over till then.
Because you do have a new album out, I believe.
I do, yes. It was out in November, called National Treasure.
You're not humble, are you?
Well, this is the one thing, like, there's no point being, you can't be doing this sort of thing and be humble.
Yeah.
I am humble, but you have to pretend you're not humble. Mr. B isn't humble, exactly. That's the thing. This is the masks. These are the little masks we put on. And, I just thought that's about time. I was called a National Treasure, so let's just, no one else was going to do it, so I might as well do it myself.
But, I mean, aren't you a National Treasure? I mean, you are documenting a sort of aspect of what at least people outside Britain think of as truly British.
Yes, yes. Well, documenting and satirising a little bit, it's a bit of both, really. It's that kind of vintage style, not vintage values thing. You know, it's... Well, it depends. You know, certain bits of vintage values that you keep and certain bits of vintage values you definitely don't keep.
Yeah.
But, well, you know, I suppose in certain quarters of the of society... I did have a walk around Brighton the other day, and you know, sometimes I'll get recognised. But it was actually a sort of street drinker yesterday who I suddenly heard someone going, "General Reimer!" I looked over and there was this guy right in a shop, in front of, you know, a shop entrance with a beer. I was like, okay, yeah, I'm big in the homeless community. That's good.
Well, I mean, who can brag of that? I mean, exactly, you take your fans where you find them, I think.
Absolutely, yeah, it's marvellous. I mean, I really didn't think that would be a thing, but there you go. Obviously, a very well, you know, a very cultured homeless chap.
Clearly, clearly. Mm. And you were, of course, wearing your full Mr. B attire.
I was. I was actually, I've got a rather nice coat, which makes me look a little bit teddy boyish. It's a sort of drape, sort of Edwardian drape coat. And I was wearing that thing. I'm actually reading a book about teddy boys at the moment, so which is really fascinating, sort of post-war, the first sort of youth cult, as it were. So, yeah, I just put this jacket on. I thought I'm going to look a bit like a teddy boy when I go out.
Yeah. Now, you were mentioning how you sort of mix up the Mr. B look by, say, suiting and trainers. And can we get into that a bit more?
Yes. Well, I think that was, you know, again, a conscious decision with Mr. B that it's because it's, you know, it's old English, you know, gentlemanly style or what have you, and hip hop. There had to be a hip-hop element to how it looked as well. So I found, you know, the classic sort of hip-hop. I call them the brogues of hip-hop. It's the Adidas Shelto or the Adidas Superstar or whatever you call it. So I tend to, yeah, you know, always with fat laces.
Yeah.
It's almost like, you know, the whole thing about you shouldn't match a tie in a pocket square. It's the same thing. If you've got a pair of Adidas Sheltos, you've got to get some big laces for them. It's just, otherwise it's just not right.
Because, I mean, clothes in the hip-hop world were as codified and specific as the sort of chap clothes. I mean, I've read quite a few issues of Chap magazine and people sending their photos to be critiqued and so on. And
yes,
there's all these rules, no brown in town and whatever. And, I mean, the hip-hop world, kind of similar in that respect, because you had to have the right trainers and the right what's-its and...
Absolutely, yes. I mean, there's a couple of great books. I mean, there's a photographer called Jamel Shabazz who documented a lot of the early hip-hop styles in New York and the Bronx, and there's a couple of books. One's called Back in the Day and one's called A Time Before Crack, I think. And, yeah, it's very, you know, although there's, like what we do, there's paths you can go off, but it's quite a uniform look. It's usually sort of lowest chords, either Puma States or Adidas Superstars, the Kazal glasses, although these are Goliath 2 glasses, which were actually worn by, I think, one of my absolute style icons is Daryl McDaniels, aka DMC from Run DMC. They wore the sort of they would have called it a fedora there, but it was kind of a Homburg, really, a Homburg, yeah. Big glasses, and, you know, they were sort of black Wranglers and Adidas Superstars, but without laces at all. But so there would be a little bit of that, but my feet are too thin, but they would just fly off. So I do need laces. But, you know, these things have to be practical as well. So yes, there was definitely, you know, a look to these things and ways that you could make it better, as it were. So yeah, and it's one of those things that, you know, you can. It's that's the whole thing with chap hop is, you know, I've said it in a few songs, is you can break the rules only when you know the rules first.
Hmm. I was listening to, was it Just Like a Chap, just before we started recording now? Which is, mm-hmm. I mean, I always, whenever I listen to it, I mean, the lyrics are so clever, because that's really based on a Public Enemy track, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yes, yes. It's, yes, the track's called Harder Than They Come. I really have no idea. I think it was just because their chorus has Flavor Flav going, just like that. And I just thought, just like a chap. Well, there you go. There it is. Simple as that. It's often these little simplest ideas you get that, yeah, send you off to do things.
It's weird because I've seen Public Enemy twice live. Once when it was in Oslo, must have been 88 on their first tour, I think, with LL Cool J supporting.
Wow.
And then I saw them again in my hometown of Tromsø 10, 15 years ago when they'd flown the whole, I think about 25 of them up to past the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
And it was quite a terrible concert, really, because they were just trying to squeeze in all these tracks in just quite a short set. So whenever they got started on one of the good ones, it was almost immediately over.
Well, that's a bit of a malaise in hip-hop live generally, I think. I've seen De La Soul at a festival years and years ago. And I remember seeing De La Soul when they first, 89 or so, but then seeing them again at a festival. And they would do that thing. They would just do a bit of a track. And usually the track would finish with, the backing track would finish and they'd go, "Aah!" And then do a lot of talking, getting people to say ho and say whoa and things like that. Yeah. And I was like, just play the tunes. But there you go.
Yeah.
Well, I do remember seeing Public Enemy at the Reading Festival in 92, and that was one of the best things I'd ever seen. It was just incredible. Even though, oddly, with their live shows, they would actually just play the track, the whole track, including the vocal track, and Chuck D would rap over the top of his own vocal on the track. It was really bizarre. But, it was all about the show, really. That's the thing.
Oddly, completely off topic, but I think the best concert I've ever been to was Ice Cube in Bradford in 92.
Right.
And then there were two rappers doing his part. Because, honestly, you get a bit tired if you're rapping all your part, but if you're doing every second line, it really works. And there was just such an energy there. It was incredible. With the Lench Mob on support, which was, at the time then, that was pretty excellent US import only top quality stuff.
No, absolutely. That sounds great. Yeah. Actually, I should do that. I should farm out every other line. That would be quite handy.
Yeah, but...
Because, it is quite tiring. You realise that. There's certain things... There's a song called Retreat on the new album that I play live, and I've got a piccolo trombone. It's like a tiny little trombone. And I do a trombone solo and then go into a rap straight away afterwards. And when I was recording it, all well and good, no problem, because you do things separately. And then I realised that doing, 16 plus bars of a rap straight after a trombone solo is quite hard work. You're quite out of puff after playing the trombone and then having to just, rap really quickly. Yeah. It was a bit of a shock when I first played it live.
Because, you do play live and it's just you and some aides, I guess.
Yes, I use the backing track and I play my banjolele, but I've been playing piano as well and I play trombone badly, in as much as I have a song called I Still Can't Play the Trombone, which I play a bad trombone solo at the end of. And I'll often tend to keep that trombone solo going at the end of the song. There's one day where I always think, in a slightly situationist prank thing, to just play that song and then just keep the trombone solo going on its own for the rest of the gig until basically everyone's left. But I don't think I'll ever quite have the guts to do that. And also, in a certain way, in the position that I am, at the level I am, you can't really be upsetting people too much because I do want people to come to my shows.
That is kind of something that's been a bit of a change in the music industry, isn't it? I remember going to gigs 20 years ago and you'd be standing around all evening waiting for the band to turn up. About 12:30, they'd roll out, obviously drunk, perform a set, graciously letting us take part in their experience, and then they'd bugger off again. But nowadays, I think bands tend to start a bit more on time and deliver what they're booked to do.
Yeah, possibly. I suppose there's things like, I know there was the Fugees reunion, wasn't there, I think, about a couple of years ago, was it? And I think Lauryn Hill just didn't turn up till, I think they went on something like four, it was an all-day sort of thing, an outdoor thing, and they turned up about 4 hours late or something like that, and they couldn't play for long because they turned up after, it was an outdoor thing, so they had to stop the sound at some point, and they turned up about 5 minutes before the sound was due to stop or something like that. Wow. So yeah, all these things still happen, definitely. But I guess the level I'm at, it's, and also with, I certainly have more of a rapport, if you were, you know, if you were with the crowd. And as far as I'm at the level when, you know, I probably know a handful of people that will be at every show, because they would have come to other shows and I'd know them through social media and things like that. You're a little bit more connected to the people that come and see you these days, which is nice. Now, much as I'd sometimes like to be a kind of prince-like figure and be very aloof and never, you know, speak to anyone or anything like that and be mysterious, it's not ideal for someone in my position. Being, if I was mysterious, I would just remain mysterious and no one would have the foggiest idea who I was.
Yeah, and I suppose it helps getting booked again and again if you're actually nice.
Exactly, yes. I think that's a large thing of it as well. Others, you know, people sometimes say that, you know, so, you know, they say, oh, it's good to work with someone who's just nice and isn't any trouble.
Liable.
But I think that's part of being, I know, you know, I do a lot of cabaret, mixed bill cabaret nights and burlesque nights and things like that. And you can usually tell the people that are just confident in what they do because they can adapt, and someone will come in and say, oh, sorry, you're going to have to go on a bit earlier than expected. They'll be like, fine. Whereas there's, you know, often the young, you know, sometimes the younger people who are less confident, if someone changes something, they'll completely, it'll throw them out and they'll, you know, go a bit mad. So it's kind of nice to be amenable to people. That's it. Be nice to people on the way up because you never know who you're going to meet on the way down.
Because at some point you will be going down, I think.
Exactly, yes. Yes, exactly.
Nature.
One way or another.
I guess the sort of Jap tweed run scheme of things has been very accommodating to you.
Yes, yes. Well, particularly the Norway tweed ride. Tweed run is always just an absolute pleasure. And I think I've done, I'm not sure if I did the first one, possibly played the first one, but I'm kind of effectively the house band, I think, now. So we, yeah, go out in Fredrikstad, and then at the end of that, I'll do a little show. And it's always an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Now, sort of, would you say you invented Jap hop?
Well, I would say, I mean, there are, you know, others, particularly one other, particularly, you know, my old nemesis, Professor Elemental. I would say I invented Jap hop as a term and as a, you know, a thing. I think Professor Elemental would have called himself more Victorian hip-hop or steampunk hip-hop or something like that, whereas Jap hop was very much my idea.
So is that the name or the content or...?
I suppose, yeah, the name, really. Just the, yeah, just calling it Jap hop. And it was so such an odd thing with that, that we both live in the same town and we were both completely blissfully unaware of each other for about a year after we'd started doing our fairly similar thing. And it wasn't until someone from another band said to me, oh, have you seen Professor Elemental? And I said, no. He said, oh, right, you should have a look. And then I had a look at him on YouTube and thought, oh, no. And then I'd look at how many views he had on YouTube and I thought, oh, no. But, yes, it's kind of, yeah, it's one of those things that we seem to be, we're almost a kind of Jagger and Richards type thing. It's kind of nice to have him around in the background and we keep an eye on each other. And if I see him doing something good, I kind of think, right, I better up my game. And then if he sees me doing something, he's similar, I think. It's quite a nice way of staying on your toes, you know, creatively. And you know, and as far as just getting yourself out there goes, it's, you know, we've always got an eye on each other.
I get an impression he's not as prolific as you are.
No, possibly not quite, no. Well, the thing is, I suppose, you know, the main difference, and I know this thing that annoys him slightly, is that I'm a kind of one-stop shop. I do everything. You know, I make the music and I produce it and I, you know, write everything and what have you. And he's a rapper, so he's not a producer. He doesn't make the music. He has to wait for someone else to make the music for him. So if, you know, I can usually just make something fairly quickly and bung it out there. Whereas he has to sort of wait to get some beats off of his producer and then do things with those. So I guess I'm more of a one-stop shop. A one-stop Jap hop shop.
It's quite clear that you have a sort of complex relationship because in one way you're both within a very, very small sphere. So you benefit from really working in that and making Jap hop a bigger thing. But at the same time you have this sort of beef going on whereby you're recording diss tracks and, as in classic hip hop,
Exactly, yes, incredible. Hip-hop lore, isn't it? That's the thing. And this is when I'd first heard he had done a diss track. You know, you're kind of slightly affronted for a moment, then you realise, actually, this is a story. That was the thing with it. It was a story, rather than like, oh, this is this bloke, and he does a thing that's sort of hip-hop as if it had been invented in the 1930s, and here's another one that's doing something similar. But then if we've got the beef, the chap hot beef, suddenly that made a story, and we were actually on the front page of the Wall Street Journal.
What?
Yes. I have a copy of the Wall Street Journal from, well, it's probably 10 years ago now, maybe even more. But yeah, when the chap hot beef started, there was someone who happened to write for the Wall Street Journal, and she was a chap hot fan, and said, I want to write about it. And it was, obviously, the Wall Street Journal is a large newspaper, and it was in the bottom corner, but it was on the front page.
Still, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was really interesting. So it's, it just made, you know, that's the thing you realise as far as, you know, in a marketing sense, it was magic. It was great for both of us. Because my fans would discover him and his fans would discover me, and they're still arguing about it to this day.
And it's not like the great Brit pop controversy where you had to follow either that band or that band.
Yeah, I mean, people have their allegiances or their favourites, but... Yeah, I think that's the thing. You know, I've lots of people who would follow me closely, and then, you know, I see them put a reel up on Instagram and using a Professor Elemental track, and I'm like, what? But, you know, it's the thing you realise that you're allowed to like both.
And it's all good fun, really, isn't it?
I mean, oh, absolutely, yes, yeah.
It is diverting. It is an alternative universe where things are actually quite okay.
No, absolutely, yes. This thing, it is sort of, it's fun. It's, like I said, it's a nice diversion. Although, we both deal with serious topics within our music, but in an amusing way. And it's, the whole beef thing is amusing. Although, at the start of it, there were people that took it very seriously. And I did get a lot of messages on YouTube, just, you know, quite aggressive messages saying, you're taking food out of his children's mouth. Ooh. Things like that. And you're like, okay, I think everyone needs to calm down here a little bit. Everything's going to be fine. We're just a couple of chaps making music.
You probably weren't. I mean, you were probably increasing his plays and...
Oh, I think so, yes. It did both the world of good, really. So it was, yeah, it was fine.
I often think when sort of small entities have more to gain by working together than sort of being enemies and just keeping things small, but...
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing. It's kind of fun that I still do. You know, we still do shows together here and there, and they're always like, "Will you do a battle?" And I'm like, it was like 12 years ago that this happened. It's quite boring now. Plus, secretly, he's a better freestyle MC than me. Oh. So we're.
That's quite an admission.
Well, I think that'd be fair to say. I mean, he does a whole part of his show, which is sort of a freestyle rap. He gets things, you know, it's an old trick, but, you know, you get people to hold things up and you make up raps about them and what have you. Whereas I tend to, I think that's the thing. My inner critic is too quick to just, I'll come up with two lines and that my brain will go, well, that's rubbish. And then yeah.
But your mind is also full of, what, 12 albums worth of tracks?
This is true. It might be 13 now, possibly. Something like that. It's 12 or 13. I can never quite tell.
So what's the trick behind freestyling then?
I don't know. There is, there's lots of reading a rhyming dictionary. And it's like a lot of things. It's just practice. Yeah. I tend to do, you know, in my spare time, I tend to be making music rather than... Yeah, rapping is the thing I find hardest to do. Because, you know, not hardest to do necessarily, but writing for an album. It's usually the one of the last things that happens is the lyrics. Often there'll usually be an idea for a song title or something like that, but it's often the dropping the bars that's one of the last things to happen.
It might just be me, but it probably isn't. But I think rap lyrics were better in the old days. there's a sort of new hip hop now. I mean, there's no rhythm to the lyrics, and they can barely make a rhyme. But if you listen to stuff like Biggie Smalls back in the day, I mean, his lines were all so complex.
Mm. Well, I think it's, I don't know, things just change, don't they, and move on. Hip-hop is not the same thing as it was, and kind of in a way, so it shouldn't be, really. It's everything changes. It's, you know, otherwise we'd all just be listening to, you know, blues and without anything else happening. But yeah, I mean, it's I think there's less. This whole thing's, well, certainly in the mainstream, it's moved towards things that are simpler and not as complex. But I think that's almost more. There's plenty of excellent complex hip hop out there. Well, like Killer Mike's just won a Grammy. He's brilliant. And there's various people who do very complex rhymes, but you don't often get to hear of them. Mm. I think that back in the day, there were less acts. And so that, you know, the kind of that sort of real hip hop, as it were, could break through. Whereas, you know, you look at Instagram, almost half of the people on there will say, you know, whatever, merchant banker, rapper. Everyone's a rapper. So, yeah, these things get a little bit watered down. But at the same time, there's still a lot of very, very good stuff out there.
I mean,
it's just you don't get to hear it as much.
The bar for making music these days has become so low. I mean, if you've got an old laptop, you download a rip-off version of whatever music software you need and bang, you're going.
Yeah, this is true. This is true. I mean, it's sort of, there's, you know, a lot to be said for democratizing things, but there's also, it means that you have to wade through so much more rubbish to get to the gold. But yes, I think there's that whole thing again of making the most of simple technology rather than it's, you know, everything's just there. You can make a track from scratch that sounds, you know, broadcastable quality without, you know, just on your phone.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's a lot more around, really. That's the thing.
I have tried the sort of digital audio workstations a couple of times, and I just get, it's just too much. But give me an old style tracker on the PC where you just find some random samples on the internet and start
exactly,
putting
yeah.
it together like Lego, and I'm all go.
This is true. Well, I'm known, you know, friends of mine who are producers, you know, my friend Ant who masters, he's from Collapse Lung, he's masters and mixes lots of my stuff. He's always kind of amused because I very rarely sort of download lots of soft synths and things like that. I do tend to, my workflow is fairly simple. It's not, I don't tend to have lots and lots of things going on. I tend to try and keep things as simple as possible and let the songs and the, you know, what I do the talking.
Yeah. So when you're out doing concerts now, in a complete U-turn of a topic, people come to see you. Do they dress up like regular music fans do to go and see their bands?
No, I tend to get, you know, often I'll try and encourage people to pop the tweed on. Obviously, at a gig, I've not worn tweed on stage for a long time because it's not ideal. As far as, you know, you can't be under these lights with, you know, very heavy wool.
I can see the problem.
It's tricky. So I tend to wear more, that kind of, you know, usually my go-to suits are, apart from the siren suits that I've recently been wearing, which are these kind of all-in-one.
We'll get back to the siren suits, yeah.
Yes, we'll discuss them. but yeah, often it's things like, well, most of the suits I'll wear, apart from those on stage, are either by Old Town Clothing or Darcy Clothing that are sort of a light cotton, but especially Darcy do one that's a kind of herringbone that looks like tweed,
right,
but it's actually just cotton, and it's just very lightweight and slightly unstructured, which I kind of like. But you know, looks absolutely chappy, you know, certainly sort of early to mid 20th century look.
Darcy, which is quite local to you, aren't they?
Yes, they're Lewis, just up the road. I think they've just closed. They did have a shop on the high street for a bit, which I think they've closed. I don't know if they've just moved everything online, but it's a shame because I did like their shop, and they previously had a shop underneath where the offices of the Chap magazine were. So that was quite a nice little going to visit, see Gustav at the Chap magazine, and then pop down and spend too much money on things in Darcy clothing.
Yeah. Old Town, of course, have been on the podcast before, but also
yes.
Quite a singular clothing company.
Absolutely. Although that said, at the moment I need to speak to them because I always love their Marshall Sea jacket was my go-to, and they've stopped making it.
Oh.
And I'm just a bit, so I think they've sort of streamlined their collection a little bit. So I think the main two jackets are the Borough and the Stanley. And for me, the Stanley's too short and the Borough's too wide. So I'm going to have to try and have a word with Marie. But
I think you're going to have to record a beef track about their lack of jackets.
I wouldn't dare have beef with Marie, bless her.
wouldn't that be a kind of fun cross-promotional thing?
It could be quite good, actually, yes. I'll do a whole track about how disappointed I am that Old Town don't make the Marshalsea jacket anymore. I might do that, actually. I'll speak to them. I still won't get a free suit off them, but why should I? You know, they cost... There's a lot of work going into those things.
I think
a lot of people try and blag. There's a place called a Thomas Farthing in London, opposite the British Museum, which is beautiful stuff, really lovely. And there was a chap who sort of got involved with Mr. B for a bit, but he was a complete blagger. And he went in there and was trying to get a free suit for me. And they were saying, look, we don't even get free suits. You know, they cost a lot of money to make and they cost a lot of time. And I was sort of stood there feeling terribly embarrassed, like a kind of child when his dad's bumped into someone he knows. But he started just completely lying, going, this guy's going to be on the cover of GQ magazine. GQ magazine, so they're going to put him. It's like, this is not... In the end, I just said, I've got to go by.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I never try, you know, if someone wants to give me a suit, there was a company called the British Tweed Company, I think, for a while, and they sent me a suit, and I know they sent Thomas Benjamin Wilde, another sort of musical comrade of mine, a couple of suits, but I think they kind of went under, because I think they were just giving away their suits all the time, and suddenly they disappeared, and I think it's because, like, no, you've got to sell these things, you know, I will buy them.
It's interesting, though, that blagger culture or influencers. And I mean, I hear from brands that they're just getting deluged with mail every day from people wanting free stuff.
Yes, I've never, you know, I always think, especially for companies like Old Town and Darcy, they're not, you know, these aren't huge conglomerates. They're just a handful of people making clothes. And, you know, they deserve to be paid for what they do. And I have people like me turning up and saying, unless, of course, you're out there and you'd like to give me anything free. But no, I'm more than happy to pay for quality items.
And unsolicited gifts is one thing, but actually having the front to go up to someone and sort of start requesting stuff, I find that really weird. And
yeah, it's like mugging them, isn't it, really?
Some place like Old Town, I mean, their stuff isn't expensive. I can't really sort of see how they're actually making it that reasonably. But
Yeah.
Then again, that might be due to being conditioned to other companies that charge such massive prices that you sort of think that things should be so expensive.
Yeah, possibly. This is, I suppose, that, you know, they're selling enough of it to make it a going concern.
Just happy.
Don't be encouraging them to put their prices up anymore, though, Nick. Don't do that.
No. Okay, I won't. Yeah. You were saying siren suits.
Yes.
Now, this is a controversial one.
Okay, yes. What do you... Yes, thing, I suppose you must have seen some of these siren suits that I wear.
I mean, the sort of... the guy that originally promoted them back in the 40s, I guess, sort of controversial, but...
Of course, yes. But, I mean, that's the thing. Controversial as far as his views and what have you. It's kind of funny how, you know, it's heartening in a way as how things have moved on that... At the turn of the century, this century, there were always the polls about who's the greatest person of the you know, millennium or what have you, and, you know, in England there was lots of, in Britain there were, you know, many polls about who's the greatest British person of the last 100 years or the last 1,000 years, and it being 1999, I think second place was always Robbie Williams, but because it's just like, why do you get the public to vote on something like this in 1999? Because it's going to be Robbie Williams. But yeah, you know, I think Churchill won, like, greatest ever Englishman or what have you. Whereas now that's not really going to be the case, just because, obviously, you know, he did a lot of good, but he was also not an enormously friendly person to certain people, no, to put it mildly. But there you go. At the same time, style-wise, he's sort of, yeah... He knew his onions a little bit.
I can't sort of unsee him with a big cigar, but then again, there's also the siren suit.
Yes, I mean, you know, there's almost, if you put siren suit into Google Images, it'll be the picture of Churchill with a cigar and a Homburg and a siren suit.
So what is the siren suit?
Well, the siren suit is, well, it's almost the Chappist onesie, if you like, or it's... basically almost like a boiler suit, but tailored. So it would have a kind of Oxford bag, trouser, a high waistband, zip or buttons, usually up to more of a, not a cutaway collar, just a standard jacket collar. But it was something that apparently it's called a siren suit, because when the sirens went off, it would be something that he could put on quickly. You know, he wouldn't have to fiddle around with braces and a waistcoat and everything like that. He could put something on and still look smart and presentable, but could be done quickly. Although that said, being someone that regularly puts a siren suit on, I wouldn't necessarily say, particularly someone of his girth, that they're very easy to put on. There's a lot of contorting has to be done to get the arms in and everything like that. But, you know, you get used to that sort of thing. So it was something also, it felt like something that was very chap hop, because it's almost, there's something slightly hip hoppy about it in a way, in a sort of maybe tracksuits of a way, perhaps. And it was just something I just thought that people just simply don't wear now. So it's kind of nice to slightly set yourself apart from the general public in what you wear, as far as, you know, if you're doing music and being on stage. So, I had a friend of ours, Louise, make this sort of the classic sort of pinstripe siren suit. And then my wife, luckily, is a costume designer. And so she made, I've got a burgundy velvet one, which is delightful. But it's kind of complete. But they are very decadent. But it's kind of worn away. I mean, they tend to, yeah, after a few, I've played a fair few shows in it, and it's kind of, everything's wearing away now. So I need to get that either another one made. Well, actually, I've got some blue pinstripe material, which I'm hoping that she'll make another one. But I've also got a sort of navy cotton drill one as well, as a kind of sort of daytime one, which is just, I absolutely love. It's just very comfy. And it's one of those things that, you know, if you're doing what I do, it's kind of nice to look a bit different. I walk down the street, even in Brighton, which is the sort of place that wouldn't turn a blind eye to anything. People are like, what's this chap wearing? So, yes, I'm a big fan of them. And as much as, yeah, they are unusual. You don't really see them. So I thought that could be a bit of my thing as well, is the siren suit. What's your take on the siren suit then, Nick?
Well, you know, there is a certain inelegance in it. It looks
perhaps,
kind
yes.
of like something a child might wear.
okay. But yeah, there's a kind of, you know, romper suit thing about it, yes.
But I suppose it depends on the situation and the person wearing it and how it fits. But I was...
Well, that's the thing. It's about the fit, because if it doesn't fit properly, it's just a boiler suit.
Yeah.
I think it's all about the fit. The fact that I had, you know, luckily I've had them made for me, so they're kind of very fitted. The top half of my one is actually based on an Old Town jacket with a slightly different collar. So it fits really nicely. And then the high waist and the Oxford bag trouser. So, you know, that with a pair of brogues, it's...
Yeah, because I was just thinking that you could sort of flip the suit with sneakers thing on its head a bit and wear brogues, but then have a siren suit made with the Adidas stripes or something, so it looks like a tracksuit.
Well, actually, funnily enough, Adidas did for a short while make... a kind of all-in-one tracksuit thing, just about a year or so ago, but it's in. It looks like a siren suit. It's the top half perfectly fitted. It's officially supposed to look like a 70s thing, but it looks, it's kind of a almost kind of camel color, and it's got the stripes down the side. Actually, it doesn't have the stripe down the trouser, only on the sleeves. Oh. And it's got a really wide, really really wide trouser. Kind of high waisty with a zip up with a really large sort of almost spear point collar, and it's kind of marvelous. It's one of those things that I think, you know, this is it's the hip hop end of chap hop, I think. But that with a nice pair of brown brogues,
yeah,
it can be done.
I can definitely.
I'll have to send you. I've got a photo of it. Actually, I did a photo session a year or so ago, and I have one with the. I'll email them over to you and you can have a look. Because it's quite, yeah, it's a little different, as it were.
Now we're sort of getting into the sort of fun aspect of clothes, which I think can also be fun. And
absolutely.
I mean, you mentioned Professor Elemental was more in the sort of steampunk vein of things. And I must say, I think, because we're sort of bordering cosplay and all this now. It's just so much creativity and fun going on there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the thing, you know, that's one of the other differences between us is it is more of a cosplay thing with Professor Elemental. It's more of a, I'm doing a gig, so I'll put the helmet and the safari suit on and do that. Whereas, you know, off screen, as it were, he's t-shirt, it's fully t-shirt and jeans sort of chap. Oh. Not really remotely interested in that kind of style. Whereas I tend to, very much kind of in a way like Prince used to be. They, you know, you had to dress like that most of the time. You know, it's you can, you know, do a pared down version, but yeah, I tend to, unless I'm wearing a polo neck or something like that, I'll tend to not feel quite right if I haven't got a tie on.
Yeah.
So it's more of a lifestyle thing. And it was actually, I think it was probably my wife that early on when I started growing the moustache for Mr. B, she just said, well, you know, you've got to dress like that now, haven't you? Because you can't have people seeing you on the street and going, I saw Mr. B on the street. He was wearing a T-shirt. What's that about? Well, you're preaching how to dress to people. But, you know, it was something I wanted to do anyway, so it was the perfect excuse to start dressing well.
That's a very interesting topic, because I was at a concert recently with a couple of my old sort of synth bands, and it was full of people there to watch, and they all had their old T-shirts on, and they had their old haircuts to fit the band and all this, and I was just there being me. Because I hadn't dressed up or dressed for the occasion at all. But I think, I don't know, as we get older, whether we sort of connect with bands in the same way. I mean, occasionally I'll see a punk in his late 50s with a fluorescent haircut, Mohican style, and I'm thinking, yeah, you never grew up, or still living the dream, or...
Exactly. That's the tricky thing, isn't it? Are you living the dream, or have you just not moved on in life?
Yeah.
Is that the thing? But that's in a way that's part of the fun of it, especially with what I do is, you know, people see often if I go up on stage to an audience that hasn't seen me before, there's sometimes a palpable sort of, oh no, what's this? Because I'm there with my banjolele in a suit and tie. And people just think I'm going to be a George Formby impersonator or something. Whereas, and then you can see their faces as they try and work out what on earth's going on. And then usually, generally, hopefully, they after a couple of songs, you can see pennies dropping around the place and people going, oh, okay, right, this is not what I thought it was. And often people will say to me after that, you know, to say, I saw you come on stage and I thought, oh, no, what's this? I don't like this. And then as soon, you know, after a while, they were like, right, okay, I'm on board now. I understand what's going on now. This is completely different. So it's kind of nice to play. And that sort of thing, dressing like I do, and people say, you know, what do you do? I say, well, I'm a rapper. And they say, people will go, what? Because that's not what they're supposed to look like. So it's always nice. I love playing with those sort of tropes.
Because going on stage, I mean, you could have been that close to actually being a George Formby impersonator.
Exactly, yes.
Or whatever.
It's, you know, it could have taken another time, another timeline. That could have been what happened.
So I gather you're off on tour soon, but streams you've been doing, what are they like?
Yeah. Yes, well, this was the whole thing. I had a, what you might call a big birthday at the very start, in April of 2020, and had a big party planned and everything like that. And there was a friend of mine was going to come out of retirement and play a show. And then obviously it all got cancelled. So on the day of my birthday, I just thought, well, why don't I just pop on Facebook and just DJ on there just to have a little party at home and try and get some people involved. And in the end, there was maybe a couple of hundred people watching.
Right.
And then after that, a lot of people said, well, can you do that next week? Because no one was doing anything. So everyone was looking for things to amuse them. So I did another one the following week. Then I think about another 2 weeks, and then I got kicked off Facebook because obviously you can't play other people's music live on Facebook. So I was banned for a couple of weeks or something like that.
Even though you're cutting the decks and whatnot and mixing up a storm. Yes.
Oh, yeah. But it's just those bots, they come and find you.
Yeah.
So I ended up moving it to a platform called Mixcloud, which, you know, they pay PRS for things and they, you know, pay royalties for things. So it's you can play what you like. And yeah, these things became known as the Nicolation parties. And then I started doing some, I think, called the School of Chap Hop, which was on a Thursday, when I'd sort of just do things like mucking around with samplers. And I've got a little looper thing that I'd beatbox into, just coming up with lots of things on the spot. Oh. It was a really good way of just keeping yourself creatively flowing and all that sort of thing. Then I started animating a video, so I'd do a stream of me just animating things. So I've kind of, you know, these things happened at various different times, so I've just brought the whole thing together. I started doing every Tuesday at 7 o'clock UK time, I would do a stream which would either be possibly an isolation or a School of Chap Hop or an animation thing, or sometimes I'd run an occasional night called Cinema Crapadiso, whereas when we just watch a terrible film, the kind of, you know, good bad film. I'm actually doing a talk about it in a couple of weeks, or I'll write that at a place called Sound Effects in Brighton, or Video Effects in Brighton, where people go and do talks about films and things, and I'm doing one about terrible films. Oh. But anyway, yeah, so they're usually on Twitch, like twitch.tv/gentlemanrhymer, and YouTube, and it's usually just me, these streams, me coming up with tunes and playing some of my own tunes and just having a general chit-chat.
How many people follow this?
Well, there's less now than there were during lockdown, obviously, because people actually have lives again now. But there's usually, I think there was maybe 60 or so on last night. It's not loads, but it's enough. To,
nice little crowd.
Yeah, and people watch it afterwards, or, you know, just generally follow it. I'd sort of end up bumping into people that, because, you know, there's this whole group of, you know, it's a group of sort of fans that have formed around it, and they call themselves the Nice Biscuits. And it's, especially during lockdown, they just formed this little sort of support group. Yeah. Which was lovely. So I've got this whole group of people that are sort of, you know, what you might call the super fans in a way, in as much as they're the people that closely follow you and you kind of, you know, they're slightly involved in what you do. And they also do a thing called Biscuit Vision, the Biscuit Vision Song Contest,
okay.
Which I started again during lockdown, which was part of all this whole thing. And I'd get people to, I'd say, right, why don't you make up a song and sing it into your phone or something like that, send me the vocal, and then we'd go on a stream and I would build a tune around it on, like, you know, on Logic or whatever, you know. I'd build a tune around it, and then at the end of it, I think it was the end of 21, had a whole night of us streaming from, me and my wife streaming from here, and we actually, someone had set up a website where you could vote for each tune, so we actually had this song contest. It was great. I'm going to try and get that going again this year, because there's already a few entries for this year's one. But yeah, things like that, just getting people involved in the whole thing, and it really makes people have a sense of ownership over it, which is one of the things that is great at being of this level and not being signed to a label. No one feels like they've been marketed to.
Yeah.
Everyone that knows what I do and follows it, they've found it themselves, and it gives them more of a sense of ownership of, like, this is my thing. This is what I like. I've not been told to like this. I've chosen this.
It's authentic.
So it's quite nice. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah, it's that kind of thing.
I mean, is it right to say that you might be the nicest guy in the music industry?
Well, I couldn't,
I mean,
possibly
a lot of
say that
are talking
myself.
About this. I mean, it's the word on the street is such.
Is that the word on the street? Well, I couldn't possibly comment on that myself.
But you can't.
That's not for me to say.
You wouldn't disagree then?
Well, I would like to not disagree, of course. I would love to think I'm the nicest man in the music business, but the main thing, I'm not really in the music business, so it's irrelevant anyway.
Okay.
I do music. Yeah, I'm in the chap hop business.
Yeah, I suppose that would be fair to say, in that you're, I mean, when you brought up the animation business as well, I mean, clearly you are multi-talented in a mixed media world.
Again, you said that, not me, but. But yeah, no, I do like to do, yeah, I kind of am quite artistic visually as well and what have you. So, I just like doing these things. And it's just, with, you know, doing this professionally, it's, you get the time to experiment with things and, you know, work out what you can do and what you can't do. So it's, you know, I'm just very lucky that I have time on my hands,
yeah.
Even though I always seem very busy. I, you know, it's the whole thing. I'm quite good at appearing to be busy, whereas a lot of the time I'm just sat around in the smoking jacket.
In the siren suit.
Exactly, sat around in the siren suit.
Yeah. Okay. Now, you're going on tour with the new album.
Yes, indeed. Yes, yes.
Worldwide?
No, just England this time. Well, this is the thing about this is one of the shames about being English, is in the post-Brexit world, it's just a little bit more tricky to travel. You know, now when I go to the Tweed Run in Norway, I am asked, "What are you doing here? Why are you here?" And I have to say, "Well, I'm just visiting friends." So they say, "What's that?" And I say, "Oh, it's just I just carry it with me, yes, the banjolele." So, yeah, you actually have. It was a real shock. It was sort of like, "Oh right, I've got to sort of go through customs and pretend I'm not working here, because suddenly we can't all work in the same place. You know, we can't all work across Europe. We're out of it now," sort of thing, which is a bit of a shame. But so it's just in England, the tour. Sorry, I just had a big moan there about the post-Brexit world for us. You know, hopefully one day we'll come back. We'll be back. You would think we'd have learnt the error of our ways, but there you go.
So
these things take time.
So the venues we'll be doing, is it just sort of smoky old working men's clubs, or is it big festivals?
It's that sort of thing. Well, the festivals are, I've got a few festivals booked in for the summer, but this is I'm just playing. Yeah, where am I playing? Sunderland, Nottingham, Cambridge, a couple of shows in London, Bristol, Norwich. And it's just sort of pubs, clubs, smallish venues, just the right amount of people, hopefully, to get a good atmosphere on the go.
Just you and the biscuits. And then,
exactly, a few of the biscuits will be there. So, yes, or whatever place. So, yeah, it should be fun, with any luck. Get your tickets from gentlemanrhymer.com and all that.
Yeah. Anything you'd like to mention in closing at all?
What would I like to mention in closing? Nothing I can think of particularly. Just, pop onto gentlemanrhymer.com. There is, of course, the Guild of Chap Hop, I should mention, this is my Patreon page, really, which I call the Guild of Chap Hop. And it's been, something I started during lockdown again, because people were very much up for supporting musicians, because suddenly I had no shows to do, and, things were quite odd. But, it's just a place where people can get a little closer in, and I did a whole free album last year, and I'm going to do a sort of little compilation of the more Mr. B the Gentleman Balladeer. So it's more of my sort of slow jams, as we'd say, and things like that, and there's a couple of new things I've written for it. So they just get free exclusive content, as it were. I don't know why I use that word particularly. Things, music, videos. So it's patreon.com/ Mr. B the Gentleman Rhymer.
Because that's a thing now, isn't it? Because you don't really make that much money off places like Spotify.
No, not a huge amount, no. I can't actually, although I don't do too badly off it, mainly because I'm not signed to a record label. Oh. So whatever revenue, whatever little revenue there is for it just comes straight to me. Mm. Rather than if I'm an artist signed to, I think that a lot of the complaints are artists signed to labels who the label will take, some of the money. Spotify will get nearly all of it, and the artist will get the tiniest fraction of it. So I don't do too badly out of that, but obviously things should be better. Yeah. But yes, but at the same time, I am on Spotify. So I'd say, buy the album on Bandcamp or from my website in physical format, or download it on Bandcamp, and then listen to it on Spotify. Best of both worlds. Everyone's a winner.
There you go. Sounds like the title for this podcast as well.
There you go.
Not download it from Bandcamp.
Well, that said, the working title for my memoir is Reasons to be Unsuccessful, Part 2.
What was Part 1?
Well, Part 1 was actually a song I wrote. I did actually do a song. There's a Mr. It's a bit of a deep dive, but there is a Mr. B album track called Reasons to be Unsuccessful, Part 1. But I also thought if I put Part 2 in it, it would make people think, well, what is Part 1? And they'd go looking for it.
I immediately took the bait, so that was a...
Oh, there you go. It's not an intentional thing. It's just a happy accident.
It strikes me that you've got built up such a universe around all this. And everything is on your website, is it?
Yes, yeah. There's, you know, all the information you need and things like that. I mean, it's very much like, I mean, I'm a huge fan of George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic and the sort of that kind of world building thing with, you know, Star Child and Sir Nose Devoid of Funk and all these sort of characters that he'd build and bands that he'd, you know, create out of nothing. It's, yeah, I kind of quite like that whole universe building thing, that there's a sort of, there's this little chap hop world that you can jump into whenever you fancy it.
So when's the graphic novel coming?
Well, there was, I used to do comics and things like that. I did think about doing a graphic novel, but it's incredibly time-consuming. I know, actually, Professor Elemental does graphic novels, but again, someone else does them. Uh-huh. He doesn't make them himself, he just puts his name to it. And whereas I'm a bit more of a control freak, I think, that I would have to. I mean, there is, I've written a novel called Roast Beef. There is a Mr. B novel, okay. And there are illustrations in that, so that's about as close as I get so far to a graphic novel. But, I did work as an illustrator for a short while, so I've got the two Chap Hop songbooks as well that you can buy, which have got a lot of, each song's got an illustration for it. Once the memoir's done, I have to work on the follow-up to Roast Beef, the next novel.
And the collectible figurines?
Well, we'll see about those, yes. I mean, some people have made things, but there's, nothing's been mass-produced yet, but we'll see.
So they're exceedingly rare.
Very rare. Well, probably not one-off, pretty much. Although someone made a thing, you can make like a little sort of cube head thing that's just a sheet of paper you can print and then cut it out and make it into a little cuboid Mr. B, which is rather fun.
Uh-huh. So creativity.
These things are out there.
Brilliant.
Indeed, yes, it's rather nice.
Okay, Jim, or Mr. B, thank you so much for joining me today.
Absolute pleasure.
Likewise. And I wish you all the best for your tour.
Thank you very much, sir. All the best to you too.
Bye-bye for now.
Tinkety-tonk.
And that was all for this week's episode. Hopefully a fresh episode next week. If you want to, make sure you download it as soon as it's out. Hit subscribe or follow. If you do listen on Apple Podcasts, I would appreciate a review and a rating. If you listen on Spotify, you can also leave a rating. If you'd like to support the pod, see the links, etc., they're in the show notes. If you'd like to get in touch, my email direct into GarmologyHQ is welldresseddad@gmail.com, or you can find me on Instagram as welldresseddad. There's also a Garmology podcast account on Instagram where you can see the artwork and info for the fresh episodes. So, bye-bye for now.